This is Bill Munhausen with another edition of What Makes Sense, starting off today with some comments about vetting candidates. There's an excellent introduction to the topic in the Watchdog Report, which reads as follows. If you pay any attention to Missouri state politics, you know there is a problem in our General Assembly. There are legislators who ran as Republicans, were elected by Republicans, and then vote like Democrats. Some deliberately lied about their values to get elected, and some are corrupted in office. Many Republican central committees in counties across the state are getting on board with vetting Republican candidates using a uniform, consistent process developed in Vernon County. This process allows Republican candidates to sign a pledge to govern based on the Republican Party platform, complete a values survey, and pass a background check. The committee is asking candidates to confirm in writing their commitment to Republican Party values like marriage, life of babies in the womb, secure borders, etc. I get it. Our conservative county wants conservatives elected to Missouri elected offices. And we've been frustrated by legislators many would call rhinos, Republicans in name only. Republicans control the governor's office and both houses of the legislature, and we still can't get good Republican leadership from Jefferson City. Unfortunately, the vetting process may not be the answer, because the cause of reforming government may need a more radical approach than mere conservatism could provide. I suspect that President Trump would not survive the vetting process if a candidate has to value traditional marriage, although it could be said he valued several of them, or protection for babies. Maybe he'd do well on secure borders, but not so well regarding the COVID vaccine. I don't have access to the values survey mentioned in the Watchdog, but I do have the Republican platform, so let's read that together. It's comprised of 8 "we believe" statements, followed by some compliments for politicians, which we can ignore. It begins with, "We believe all people are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, including life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is our fundamental belief that our morals, our values, and our culture are derived from Almighty God. To quote the psalmist, blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord," Psalm 33:12. As a former Creation Museum operator, I can wholeheartedly praise the sentiment, but what does it really mean? Years ago, I attended a West Side Ministerial Alliance meeting to talk about creation and found that half the pastors didn't believe in the Genesis account. They had all wrestled with the disconnect between creation and evolutionary science and decided on some form of compromise. When Christians visited my science center, each one had some crazy idea about what God might have done and how it all lines up with science. But there was little consensus about what creation really meant. As a result, anyone can claim agreement with the first tenet of the Republican platform, because each person interprets creation the way they choose. Aside from that, does this mean you have to be a conservative Christian to be a Republican? Are we really the Christian party? There's actually a lot of truth in that, but it's not a good strategy for successful politics. Like it or not, separation of church and state, however flawed it is still a dominant philosophical rule in American politics, and a Christian party will likely remain a minority party. The second tenet reads, "We believe that the strength of America is in the hearts and homes of its citizens." Well, what politician wouldn't sign on for something as vague as that? The third tenet reads, "We believe in the right of Missourians to be secure in their persons, their homes, and their communities." Once again, that's easy to support, but government will take away your home if you don't pay your taxes. Government can also use eminent domain to take your property if they can justify it for the public good. The next tenet reads, "We believe government governs best when it governs least." I'm pretty sure that's not true either. The reality is that conservatives want to vet Republican candidates so we can elect better Republicans. And we're doing that so our government can do what we want. If we really wanted a government that governs least, we might be content with the government we have. I also suggest that state government shouldn't be too small, or Missourians will be even further at the mercy of the federal government. What may actually be needed in Missouri is a governor who is the conservative antithesis of Governor Newsom in California. We may need a governor who can build Missouri up to be so principled and independent that we can defy regulations and mandates from Washington, D.C., so we can limit federal influence. Just food for thought. A smaller and weaker Missouri can't resist federal overreach. Another tenet reads, "We believe all political power is vested in and derived from the people. All government originates from the people, is founded upon their will only, and is instituted solely for the good of the whole by protecting the unalienable and God-given rights of the people." I really do love the language of America's founders and find it inspiring, but it rings rather hollow today. As one of the people, I don't know how to assert my will over the government. Here's a silly anecdote. I owned an investment property in Warren, Ohio, and was billed once a quarter for rainwater abatement, apparently a fee for letting rain go into the city drainage system. The city required that I set up an automated payment for that bill. When I sold the property, I assumed they would stop taking my money, but they did, and now won't return my calls to get it refunded. Apparently, government authority isn't derived from me in any practical way. It's just nice words and a simple statement of agreement won't change things. Then we have a tenet that says we believe the role of the federal government should be to ensure domestic tranquility, to provide for the common defense, and to promote the general welfare. And we believe the 10th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution grants all other duties to the states. The general welfare phrase blows it all up by justifying any action by government that is intended to produce a generally good result. Again, it's an easy statement to support because no candidate is obligated to do anything about it. There are a couple of more tenets, but you get the point, and I'm developing a bad attitude. It's easy for a candidate to affirm agreement with a platform when it doesn't require any particular performance. Let me relate all of this vetting back to a favorite story from Bible history, the story of Abraham being called by God to sacrifice his son Isaac. God spoke to Abraham to tell him to sacrifice his only son, and God saw Abraham make preparations to do so. God also knew that Abraham wanted in his heart and mind to obey God. But here is the conclusion of the event as recorded in Genesis 22:10-12. Then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham." And Abraham replied, "Here I am." The angel said, "Do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." The way God vetted Abraham was not by hearing his words or reading his intentions. God judged the actions, and thankfully he judged before the final act was completed. So as much as I admire any attempt to make sure our candidates are forthright about their intentions, God's attitude is we judge them by their works. As American citizens and voters, we can't trust the intentions of candidates no matter how we formulate surveys and platforms. We must judge based on actions. The truth is, if we have rhinos in office, it's because the voters are okay with them. President Trump was a kind of rhino before he was elected, but his actions conformed well with Republican ideals, and the majority of Americans judged him favorably by what he did when he finally entered office. Where we could do better is to evaluate the performance of office holders after their first term. If we don't approve, work to remove them. Let's vet according to their actions. Many of the news stories I look at dovetail together to involve similar topics. Here's one about Missouri broadband access. Issues involve what we expect from government and whether we are really committed to fiscal responsibility. And did I mention how I hate grants? The article claims that 400,000 Missouri households lack internet access. Sounds like a personal problem to me. People choose to live in places that don't have high-speed internet, and even purchase new homes without checking into it and then expect the government to fix it. The story goes on to say Millions of dollars in federal funds are being used to do just that. I have long been a critic of federal grants for these reasons. First, the federal government doesn't have the money, is deeply in debt, and can only give grants by having the Federal Reserve Bank print more dollars. Printing dollars makes every dollar worth less, which makes it easier to give away, but results in inflation that reduces the purchasing power of every individual citizen. It's a hidden tax. Missouri politicians love to say how frugal they are, and even talk about refunding tax money, but then they go out and get supposedly free money from Washington, D.C. When government goes out to get grants, they are telling every taxpayer that what you are giving is not enough. It's an insult to every citizen, and it makes government less accountable to the people. Whenever this argument is raised, someone says, if we don't take the grant money, somebody else will. Nevertheless, somebody has to take a stand for the long-term good of the people because we live every day with the consequences of printing free money. The article also asserts that the pandemic made us aware of how much we need internet access, but that's pretty much a lie. The people who live where internet access isn't available almost certainly haven't been given an option to work from home by their employers. As far as doing schoolwork from home, the harmful effects of doing school from home are so well documented that we will likely never do it again. But maybe I'm too optimistic regarding the good sense of institutional managers. Unfortunately, once bureaucrats are sent into action, it takes on a life of its own. Missouri created the Office of Broadband Development under the Department of Economic Development way back in 2016. Since then, there have been many failed discussions about how to increase broadband, but now the pandemic is being used as an excuse and motivation to bull forward with something. The head of broadband development, B.J. Tanksley, recognizes the high cost of broadband, but sees an opportunity. Unlike years past, money is now flush in the Show-Me State thanks to $265 million from American Rescue Plan, ARPA funds, to expand internet access. This quote says something about the bureaucratic mind. Tanksley wrote, "That's where we'll be able to address digital literacy and making sure people are fully prepared to engage with the internet. It doesn't matter if you have a connection if you don't see the value in it, and you're not able to fully take advantage of it. In other words, it doesn't matter if you don't think you need internet access, we'll make sure you think you need it." Tanksley is already lobbying for more, saying, the federal money isn't enough to make sure every Missourian has access. To close all the gaps, it would cost roughly $2 billion. Bureaucrats tend to overstate a problem in order to justify solving it. People who live in remote areas don't universally want internet access. Those that do want access can get reasonably priced cellular service for as little as $15 a month. The only reason those solutions aren't considered is you can't maintain a cushy job at the Capitol with such a strategy. Here's another headline. Missouri is above average in teen pregnancies and STDs. Could comprehensive sex education help? Comprehensive sex education has been touted for decades as a solution to these problems. But new generations of young people continue to fail the test. The data indicates states like Missouri that do not mandate sex education in school have higher teen pregnancy and STD rates. But is this causation or merely correlation? Missouri also has higher rates of mental illness than other states. So mental deficiency can just as easily be the cause for risky sexual practices. Or higher poverty levels could be a cause. The list goes on. This is the problem with studies regarding human behaviors because there are generally multiple factors affecting behaviors, and researchers often jump to a wrong conclusion. The reality is that young people are better educated than journalists acknowledge. For the sake of a story, journalists will get some ridiculously unrealistic quotes, such as one in this article claiming a teenager did not know how to use a condom. Of course, teenagers shouldn't be using condoms, but if they acquire one, the use is pretty intuitive. However, if you are presenting education as a solution, journalists have to establish that ignorance is the problem. But it isn't true. It is naive to think that education can solve every problem, and the calls for sex education as a solution disregards the human element. Even in modern America, kids know they are doing wrong when they are sexually active, but they do it anyway. The primary cause is that the entertainment industry immerses everyone in sexuality, and teens are especially susceptible to influence. Teenage girls aren't always trying to avoid pregnancy because they yearn for the love of a little baby. Teenage boys often see sexual activities as a bridge to manhood. There are many other reasons for teens being sexually active, and education often makes it worse by bringing sex to the forefront of their thoughts. One insightful section of the article pointed out another problem with comprehensive sex education because all of the gender issues are now embedded in the secular concept of what is comprehensive. Therefore, modern comprehensive sex education has to include same-sex attraction and practices and propaganda about gender fluidity and the supposed oppressiveness of traditional gender identity. As a result, even those who favor some form of sex education cringe at the thought regarding what will be included. No, comprehensive sex education in schools is not the answer because of the destructive attitudes it will include. For millennia, people have muddled through learning about sex with their own families being the model for how to live. That system worked surprisingly well when families were strong and independent. But the same educational experts who advocate sex education have also worked to undermine the family institution. If we truly want to reduce pregnancy outside of marriage and sexually transmitted disease, we need to reform all of society to support more responsible lifestyles. Teach young people about respect for their romantic partners. Encourage the entertainment industry to stop glamorizing sexual excess. Stop telling young people that homosexual behavior is normal, when it clearly is not. None of this is the responsibility of public school, but rather the mission of families, churches, civil government, and responsible media. Christians need to lead the way because our secular institutions are too corrupt to consider it. The rest of this episode will be about Israel and Hamas, beginning with a guest editorial from the Camden County Reporter newspaper. It begins with, "Nothing has highlighted how splintered American opinion can be than the Israel-Hamas conflict." Frank Mercer quickly acknowledges that Americans are divided about so many issues like racism and gender, but this conflict seems different because of its generational divide. The young pro-Hamas marchers hold positions that are impossible to comprehend, especially among university students who should be among the best educated young Americans. Perhaps they are really the best indoctrinated rather than the best educated. However, when you consider the bias of university educators against anything Judeo-Christian, the animus against Israel makes perfect sense, since Israel is the root of all the denominations of people who love God, and political leftists hate religion. However, an aspect of this animus that makes less sense is the corresponding favor for Hamas, whose root is the religion of Islam. If leftists believe religion is bad, why not oppose Islam also? Rabbi Eli Mishel suggests that there may be an Old Testament prophetic cause. The book of Obadiah prophesies about Edom, the nation that descends from Jacob's brother Esau, who sold his inheritance to Jacob and became known as the forefather of the Arab nations. Edom was located to the south of Israel on the strategic trade route between Arabia and the Mediterranean. By the time the Romans destroyed the Second Temple in Jerusalem in 70, it says CE, how about AD? The Edomites had disappeared from history, but Edom wasn't completely gone from Jewish consciousness. In Jewish tradition, the term Edom is broadly used to refer to the Roman Empire and the nations of Western civilization that are the spiritual descendants of Rome. In other words, the book of Obadiah's prophecy about Edom is actually a warning to the Western nations of our time, the United States included. Jewish sages explain that Obadiah's prophecy speaks of the end of days, about the time period of the war of Gog and Magog. But while the prophets Ezekiel and Zechariah address the evil Gog himself, the Islamic nations of Ishmael who will actively attack the people of Israel, Obadiah addresses the descendants of Edom, the Western nations that will support and encourage the Islamic nations who attack Israel. One of those sages of the Middle Ages, Maimonides, wrote that there will be some sort of union between the nations of Edom and Ishmael during the end times. And this is the strange alliance we are seeing between Western secular academia and Islamic jihadists. This may explain the all-too-common occurrence on American college campuses today, in which young, naive, and spiritually lost Americans, the people of Edom, turn to radical Muslim professors and student groups to find direction and purpose in their lives. Tragically, hundreds of thousands of students, many of them raised in Christian and Jewish homes, have been radicalized in this way. They seem to support an ideology that actually hates them. The LGBTQ plus members of these activists, who so passionately support Hamas terrorists, would be butchered by Hamas if they dared to step foot in the Gaza Strip. Yet they support the jihadists, who despise them. The Obadiah prophecy goes on to say, "So said the Lord concerning Edom, we have heard tidings from the Lord, and a messenger has been sent among the nations. Arise, and let us rise up against them in war." According to Rabbi Mischel, this is precisely what is occurring today, as imams throughout Europe teach their followers to embrace jihad, hate Jews, and overthrow the Western nations. They are openly declaring their true goal, to take over the West from the inside, but few people are taking them seriously, as Americans in particular are squabbling internally over gender identity, racism, and elections. The downfall of the West will not occur overnight or in spectacular fashion. Rather, the enemies of Edom, the Muslim Ishmaelites, will sneak up on the West like thieves who take everything you own as you sleep. The Western nations, once led by wise leaders, will lack wisdom at the end of days. In our generation, European and American leaders are concerned about transgender rights and foolish debates about who qualifies as a woman, while they are oblivious to the Muslim immigrants who are preparing to conquer their nations from the inside. Most of the European nations have already caved to Islamicism, cowering helplessly as brazen Muslims and their supporters take over the streets of London and Paris. What about the ostensible leader of the West, the United States of America? Though the majority of Americans support Israel, over 50% of young people support the Hamas invaders, who torture Jewish women and children. As these young people grow older and assume the leadership of the nation, America will become more like ancient Edom, and it's not too late to reverse course. Let's finish the topic on an upbeat note. A recent headline proclaims Dutch far-right takeover is a terrifying shock for Europe. That doesn't sound upbeat until you realize this headline comes from a leftist source, and it's only terrifying for those leaders in the West who want to keep their heads in the sand regarding the threat of Islamic immigration and the risk of importing jihadists into their countries. This report is about Dutch political leader Geert Wilders, who they refer to as an anti-Islam populist. They add that Wilders' election victory is sending shockwaves throughout Europe, where extremist nationalist ideology is putting pressure on democracies that now face the possibility of having to deal with the first far-right prime minister of the Netherlands. A key word in this article is populist, which my dictionary describes as a politician who strives to appeal to ordinary people who feel that their concerns are disregarded by established elite groups. Once you read the definition, being a populist seems like a pretty good thing. Many of the common people in Europe are waking up to the way their societies and culture are being disrupted by Middle Eastern immigrants, whose culture and values are greatly different from theirs, and they are desperate for solutions. They are not anti-Muslim. They just want Muslims to stay in their own countries so that Europeans don't lose their national identities. Geert Wilders is that rare politician who represents the people's interests in the great American tradition of government by the consent of the governed. The European elites want the governed to serve the government, so populist leaders freak them out. A corresponding awakening is taking place in the United States. Donald Trump was one of those populist leaders who was elected to champion we the underdogs in American politics. Our American elitists, like the Europeans, were freaked out by an outsider threatening their control of positions of power, and they worked throughout President Trump's first term to take him down. Their efforts became even more intense once the president was removed from power, and they are working even now to keep him from running again. But a large percentage of Americans have had enough and have given Trump an overwhelming advantage leading up to the next election. They identify with him even if his persecutors brand him as a criminal. We are all anticipating either the rebirth of our nation or another step in its demise. Thanks for joining us today. Until next time, go out and do good.